numbers. According to, pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call the House Human Services Finance and Policy Committee to order. The first thing we're going to do is call the roll. So if Ms. Hansen can call the roll, and all you need to do is say present if you're here. Go ahead, Ms. Hansen.
Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner. Representative Albright.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Keel.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Pearson.
Pearson present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Sandel.
Present.
Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Thank you all.
Okay, thank you. We do have a quorum present. The next item is we need to look at the minutes. So those were all sent to you. They're also posted on our committee website. So does anyone want to make a motion to approve the minutes from January 14th?
So moved, Madam.
Thank you. Representative Noor moves the minutes from January 14th, 2021. Any discussion of the minutes? Just make sure your name is there. Okay, hearing none, those in favor, please unmute yourself. Say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, so the motion prevails. The minutes for January 14th, 2021 are approved. So members, today we have a full hearing, and we're going to hear three separate topics. The first one we're going to start with is continuous quality improvement update from Commissioner Harpstead. And then we'll talk about the MFIP program, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, and TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Federal Block Grant Program. So I see that Commissioner Harpstead is with us, and I think her audio is now fixed. So Commissioner Harpstead, welcome to our committee, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. I'm very grateful to be with you this morning, especially since I had to go out and back in five times to get my audio to work today. So after last week, when I did an introductory presentation on DHS to this committee, I was asked to come back and say some more about the process controls that we put in place over the course of the year 2020. So you'll remember a year and a quarter ago, I came to the Department of Service, came straight into a hearing with this committee to talk about my 90-day plan, saying there's nothing more important for the Minnesota Department of Human Services than to be trustworthy for the people of Minnesota, trustworthy to the people who depend on our services to live full lives in community, and trustworthy to the taxpayers whose resources we are entrusted with to use them properly, wisely, and effectively. When we finished the 90-day plan and gave a 90-day report, we also created the Commissioner's Advisory Panel. I was grateful to have the co-chairs, Dr. Penny Wheeler of the Allina Health System and Bill George, former CEO of Medtronic, to chair the panel, as they have both run billion-dollar-plus operations. Other members of the panel included the four legislative chairs of our four Health and Human Services committees in the House and the Senate, and was so grateful to have an opportunity to have them join us and to discuss these issues with us throughout the year, not just in session. Julie Ring, Association of Minnesota Counties, was on the panel, as was Louise Mattson, the Executive Director of the Division of Indian Work, Bishop Richard Howell of the Pentecostal Assemblies of the World, Andrea Falk is a current DHS employee and a MAPE representative, and Tom Moss, a former DHS assistant commissioner who many of you know. The charge of that panel was to continue to monitor progress on DHS's 90-day plan and report and advise the commissioner. In regard to those 2019 overpayments that made so much news, we have since cleaned all those claims and repaid CMS, the federal government, for the tribal MAT and county IMD overpayments. In lieu of 2020 legislative action to repay these items, we are pursuing our administrative options to recover those overpayments, as I am required to do by law. My December 2019 90-day report added up every error we could find in 2019 and pointed out that they added up to 0.1% of our payments over 6 years and that the department was not in total chaos. And in order to go after that 0.1%, we initiated Operation Stopgap and Operation Swiss Watch and brought in an outside national consultant to review our process control steps and appointed internal process control champions. We also further centralized financial and compliance functions across DHS. The top of this slide was in that 90-day report asking the question, does the federal government ever pay us back? So at the top was recent errors for which DHS has had to repay the federal government, $103.3 million. Recent items for which the federal government has had to repay DHS, $94 million. In 2020, working with CMS, we discovered drug rebates that DHS was eligible to recover from the pharmaceutical industry for the state general fund, and we added $74 million to the state general fund this fall. And I'm very pleased to say that 2020 errors for which DHS will have to repay the federal government were zero. This shows you our new process control champion chart. At the top in the dark blue boxes are four assistant commissioners and Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson. Reporting to Deputy Commissioner Johnson is Assistant Commissioner Marshall Smith, who runs our direct care and treatment services. Each of our assistant commissioners this year appointed a process control champion, and you can see their names there as well. These are five people who report directly to the assistant commissioner, sit in on all the staff meetings, and are kind of the right-hand person of the assistant commissioner, making sure that administration dots the I's and crosses the T's on all major decisions. So these people have other responsibilities, such as chief administrative officer, that sort of thing in these divisions. These aren't new jobs, but they were given this new title and asked to particularly champion the idea of process control across their administration. They all have a dotted line to our chief compliance officer, Shireen Gandhi, who holds regular meetings with them to help them learn process control processes and efforts. I want you to know they're not the only people who are dotting the I's and crossing the T's. The orange boxes just show you some of the titles of people who are also making sure we do things correctly across DHS, including compliance people, contract people, grant managers, etc. Operation Stopgap began a contract review across all of our administrations and completed all of them in 2020. And we pay particular attention to our behavioral health division in our community supports administration, which needed to have a turnaround in terms of the approach that they took to these process controls. Gertrude Matembo-Mataza, Assistant Commissioner for Community Supports, came to us after a successful turnaround of the Phyllis Wheatley Center. Paul Fleischner has come to lead the behavioral health division via an intergovernmental agreement with Olmsted County, where he was a well-respected deputy county administrator. Jennifer Yang joined the Community Supports Administration from her role as one of the strongest leaders in our compliance department and became the process control champion in that administration. And together, they're implementing a solid plan to fix the division's approach to grants and contracts. Operation Stopgap's contract review of the Community Supports Administration led to these potential actions: enhanced coordination and communication, a collaborative safety environment and culture of accountability, strengthening financial management, oversight, and internal controls, hardwiring those improvements and standardizing processes, and integrating the approach and streamlining the process. Within the Community Supports Administration, this is their own plan. This is actually Jennifer Yang's plan, the process control champion, working on their contract process, their contract system, and then contract policy and training. As you can see, if you were to read down this chart in each of the boxes, by April, we will have done a test of our a test will begin in our behavioral health division. And by October, they hope to share all of their learnings with the entire Community Supports Administration. We're eager to see how this goes, because if this works well after that, they can share everything they've learned with the other administrations across DHS. In terms of our other audit findings in 2020, we had a federal Medicaid payment to MCO audit with no significant findings. This is the federal pharmacy rebate audit that I mentioned earlier, and we've been working with them since the early 2010s, and they've been helping us find drug rebates we should be getting, adding $74 million to the state general fund. We're proud that an IT system penetration test by the federal government discovered that no DHS employee clicked the link, keeping our computer systems safe. A federal dual eligibility audit was conducted that determined we could more accurately identify beneficiaries who might be concurrently enrolled in two different states if we only use the database to which we do not have legal access. I think that a federal audit was done because the people doing it wanted to be sure that the federal government eventually gave the states access to that database, but it was an unusual audit. And finally, the Minnesota Office of the Legislative Auditor did an MCO dental and mental health encounters audit, finding minor issues that were found and corrected. Operation Swiss Watch kicked off in 2020 and is a much more sophisticated and complex approach to identifying root causes for all 2019 billing and payment issues. Their intent is to implement business process controls and improvements to increase and maintain the accuracy of eligibility determinations and to develop an ongoing agency-wide monitoring plan to mitigate risk and address issues. They did a discovery activity in every one of our administrations, which were completed in 2020. And this is their current chart of items. Having just finished, the external contractor has recently finished all their interviews and documentation. And we will be seeing a report soon from that external contractor, along with our Office of Continuous Improvement's internal findings. And we'd be delighted to share that with you once we receive it. And COVID. Operation Stopgap continued uninterrupted in the pandemic, while Operation Swiss Watch was delayed by a few months, while our continuous improvement people went to help set up the SEOC's operations to deal with the virus. On the other hand, COVID gave us an unprecedented opportunity to run every COVID waiver through a policy review committee of commissioners' direct reports, so that every assistant commissioner and team who wanted to waive rules and regulations saw us modeling firsthand our process of crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's before approving waivers. I would not use our executive order authority to approve a waiver until I had a thumbs up on WebEx from our legal department, our financial department, and the people who know all of the CMS rules every time. We finished our strategic plan in 2020, and I just wanted to point out the three areas: our Stand for Better Health, Fuller Life, and Lower Cost, our Culture of Equity, and at the bottom, we intend to be nationally ranked as a well-run state agency. So the biggest issue of 2020 was process control, right? And then along came COVID-19, George Floyd, and the issues of ongoing racism in Minnesota, our state budget deficit, and concerns about federal healthcare policy. Lessons learned from 2019 is that democracy isn't easy. When we run billions of dollars of taxpayer money and every Minnesotan has an opinion about how it should be spent, we quickly become a department everyone loves to criticize. I have now worked for a year with some of the most caring, competent leaders I have ever worked with. I'm astounded at the capacity of this department to keep its regular work going on top of its COVID response. And I've been impressed with their ability to embrace new thinking like breakthrough goals, our anti-racism initiative, and process control champions. As we work to further develop a culture of anti-racism, collaborative safety, and responsiveness to community, I would ask Minnesotans to look at the department's overall results, read the stories of the lives supported with their tax dollars through DHS's work, and make a fair judgment of the total picture. the silver linings of COVID, actually. The DHS senior team bonding and modeling, crossing T's and dotting I's. Closer than ever, collaboration between DHS and our HHS legislative chairs, who we talked to more than ever throughout 2020. Closer than ever, collaboration and responsiveness with counties and tribes as we all had to get together to talk about how to flex the things that we do to keep everything going during the pandemic. Closer than ever, collaboration and responsiveness with other state commissioners, the governor's office, and COVID work groups. I've talked to my fellow commissioners far more during COVID than I had the opportunity to do before it. The testing of some waivers that should be permanent policy. Our behavioral health division was able to complete a study of the efficacy of behavioral telemedicine for your consideration in making behavioral health telemedicine a permanent policy. And then developing the capacity and possibility, especially of remote work and remote services, and the emergence of what I call tele-everything. In every sector in which I've worked, for-profit, nonprofit, and government, we've all come home from national conferences thrilled to be working in Minnesota. I have learned over the years that Minnesotans uniquely believe that we have an obligation to care for our neighbors, and if we apply ourselves, we can make things right. Minnesotans love and excel at the art of democracy. So bring on the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner Harbstad. Really appreciate those comments. And we're so grateful to have you at the helm of DHS. It's really impressive that it was about 0.1% of payment issues over 6 years. I think we really need to highlight that. Given all the money that flows through DHS, I think that's impressive. And I know you're doing so much better now and going through the process controls. I just have one question before I open it up to other members. Can we look back farther and look at additional pharmacy rebates? And how did you identify that we were eligible but weren't pursuing those initially?
That's a good question, and I would have to go back and ask some questions about that. I know the federal folks came in and wanted to look back that far, and I imagine it has something to do with the timing of our MCO contracts. But I'll go back and ask those questions and see what else we can learn from that.
Thank you, Commissioner Harbstad. Any other questions from members? Okay, Representative Neuer, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question in regards to EVV, which was supposed to help us with some of the streamlined process. We got the waiver from the federal government to wait until January 2021. Can you brief us where we are with EVV? EVV is the electronic verification process.
Sure. Madam Chair. Matt Burdick, I wonder if you're on and can comment about where we're at with EVV.
Sure, Mr. Burdick, if you're on, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. I apologize, my internet connection has not been great this morning, so I missed the question. If you could please repeat the question.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, again. This is a question regarding the EVV implementation. We received a good faith exemption, as I assume, and the program was supposed to be effective the first quarter of 2021. I don't know if I'm reading that correctly. Do we have an update on EVV?
Mr. Burdick?
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks for repeating the question. I'm actually going to defer to my colleague, Dave Greenman, who's also on the line and can speak to that more cogently than I can.
Thank you. Mr. Greenman, are you there? If so, please proceed.
Madam Chair, Representative Neuer, we have had some delays in implementing EVV. At this point, we expect that we will be subject to a financial penalty, which is in the federal law, which results in a reduction in our federal financial participation for medical assistance for PCA services. And I believe it's a fraction of a percentage that comes off, and I'd have to look at the exact amount, but we do have that in the forecast that we will be penalized. We think that we'll probably be able to implement full EVV by the end of 2023. So it is taking quite a bit longer. We are, however, in the company of a lot of other states. There are about 40 states that asked for a waiver due to the that Representative Neuwirth was just mentioning, to allow us to extend the EVV, the period by which we need to implement EVV. We are still hopeful that the federal government may intervene at some point and extend the waiver further so that we can avoid a penalty, but we have not heard anything about that at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Representative Noor, do you have a follow-up question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll follow up with the department just to inquire further, so thank you.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, you mentioned in your comments you are pursuing legislative action to recapture repayment to the feds. And I'm wondering if that speaks to House File 111.
Commissioner.
Chair Schultz and Representative, I understand there are bills. I don't know the numbers. Pursuing potential legislative payment of those overpayments. What we are pursuing is the administrative approaches that we have at our disposal, and whether or not those are successful in the legislature.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, could you speak to that process? I'm certainly familiar with the legislative process, and I'll take that up with the authors. But I'd like to know what administrative tools you are using. And where would that money come, if you are successful, where would that money, where did it come from initially, and where will it come back to, given the fact that the money was first appropriated from the general fund?
Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative. The administrative approaches that we are pursuing is with the tribal MAT payments. That is going through an administrative law review process right now. And we're waiting to hear what the administrative law judge has to say about those payments. On the county side, we have a meeting set up with the Association of Minnesota Counties and several of the counties to talk about a long-term payment plan. I am able to offer a long-term payment plan, which would spread the payments of those overpayments back to us over the same number of years they were received. And we'll be talking with the counties about that possibility. All of this flows back and forth through the general fund, both the times that the tribes and the counties received more than they should have for these services, and if they then use that process to pay them back, the payments back would flow in the other direction.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you spoke fairly extensively about the champions with regard to process controls. And in relationship to this process, which certainly could have used some oversight, late to the dance on that, but how would it be different under your current champions of oversight? How would you prevent that from happening again?
Yes,
Commissioner.
Chair Schultz and Representative Albright. So what we're working to do first is establish a culture of process control, crossing T's and dotting I's, certainly being supportive of Minnesotans and their needs, but also making sure that we take very, very good care of the dollars that are sent to us to use to support people in Minnesota. And so it's creating a culture of, we don't go ahead and take a major decision on a new payment without checking everything first, legally, financially, and in terms of CMS, if it's a federal sort of a payment. And again, we've been modeling that throughout COVID, and our process control champions in meetings are going to be saying, did you check everything on that? Have you checked with so-and-so? Did you ask this question? As we've been teaching them to do as we've gone through our COVID waivers. So it's a culture change. Then we will also, as we finish Operation Swiss Watch and learn what they learned from a very thorough and exhaustive study of how processes go in our departments today, we'll implement whatever recommendations they have. And I'm sure that is going to include documenting and making sure that correct signatures are on forms to prove that people asked all the right people all the right questions before making major payment decisions.
Madam Chair, just one follow-up for the
commission. Go ahead, Representative Albright.
You have articulated a broad cross-section of champions for various process controls, but I see one lacking, and I'm just wondering if you omitted it or if it's included in or embedded in one of them. With regard to you, do you have a champion for process controls surrounding data matching?
Commissioner?
Actually, in terms of data matching, our whole compliance department and internal audit department would be engaged in that. And so the process control champions are deployed in our different administrations to make sure that our administrations are all thinking the same way that our compliance department is. But our compliance department and internal audit department would be seeing to things like data matching across the board.
And Madam Chair, if I could ask the commissioner, who would that person be at the top of the org chart for your audit team that would oversee that issue?
Commissioner? Gary Johnson. Oh, sorry. Sorry, Madam Chair. And Representative Gary Johnson is our internal auditor.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm not seeing any more questions for the commissioner. Thank you, Commissioner Harpstead. We will let you go and introduce our next topic. So the next presentation is about the Minnesota Family Investment Program. This is an overview, members. And we have Deborah Schillick available to testify, I believe. And then we have a guest presenter after Ms. Schillick. Are you on?
Chair Schultz, yes, I am.
Thank you. Proceed and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Deborah Schillick. I work in the Economic Assistance and Employment Supports Division on the policy team. That's the division in which we oversee many of the public assistance programs to families. I'm going to give a very brief high-level overview of the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It provides income support to families in poverty with children. This program, just a piece of history, from 1935 during the Depression until 1996, there was a federal program, the Aid to Families with Dependent Children, that did this work. That was replaced in 1996. When that program was discontinued, Congress instead voted to provide block grants to the states to run their own income support programs. That block grant is called the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, and information about that will be in the follow-up presentation. There are a couple of significant policy pieces Congress put in place with that major switch. One was lifetime limits. With small exceptions, families can receive no more than 60 months of income support throughout their lifetime. And with that income support came work requirements. So Minnesota took that opportunity of welfare reform and created the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It provides income support and employment services to families with children in deep poverty. The emphasis is on children. That's the first condition of eligibility. It could be a pregnant woman with no other children or families raising children. And the assumption behind this effort is the recognition that children growing up in poverty are highly likely to fall behind in school, experience poor health, have diets that lack in important nutrition, and as adults will have chronic illnesses and shortened lifespans. So in 2019, an average of not quite 29,000 families a month received assistance through the Minnesota Family Investment Program. 72% of the people are children. The average number of children per family is 2, and 2/3 of the families have a child younger than 6. Families turn to MFIP for assistance under 3 common circumstances. Most commonly, they're low-wage workers, or their parents with significant impairments to work, serious mental illness, low IQs, illness that incapacitates them, or they're recently arrived refugees with children. I want to talk about the low-wage workers who turn to MFIP because that's the most common circumstance we see. Next slide, please. More than 2/3 of the parents turning to MFIP have just lost or left a job. The majority of those jobs are in one of 4 industries: hotel, restaurant, retail, healthcare, and temp agencies. These industries have the highest turnover of workers as industries in Minnesota. They also have the lowest proportion of workers who receive unemployment insurance. The General Accountability Office for Congress in 2003 did analysis. Low-wage workers are 2.5 times as likely to lose work, but only half as likely to collect unemployment insurance as higher paid workers. So when parents turn to the Minnesota Family Investment Program, they have to meet the eligibility conditions, not only to have a child, but to be income eligible. So on this slide, you see what that looks like. For instance, for a family of 2, that's less than $23,000 a year. For a family of 3, less than about $29,000 a year. For a family of 4, less than $35,000 a year. And they also can have no more than $10,000 in assets. There are three major policies to the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Like the federal government has said, most families cannot receive more than 5 years of assistance over their lifetime. The federal law allows us to exempt up to 20% of the families we serve from that. Minnesota has done that by identifying families for whom employment is very difficult. I'll talk about that in 1 minute. Parents are subject to work requirements. And we have a special services track this legislature created, which offers more flexible services to families in which significant barriers, such as mental illness, low IQs, incapacitating illness, make work difficult. Those are the same conditions which can get someone an exemption from the lifetime limit. We call that service track the Family Stabilization Services. So to that issue about time limits, most families don't rely on MFIP benefits for a long time. 42% of all new applicants will use MFIP once for 12 months and then be done with the program. Since the program was launched in 1998, about 7% of all families served reached the 60-month time limit. So the time limits are there. Some families are impacted by them, but many families never get close to that time limit. The work requirements that I referenced, 3 key requirements. Parents receiving MFIP assistance must develop and then sign an employment plan. That signature is their commitment to following through on the plan. If they do not have a job, they must participate in activities or services to help them prepare to return to work. And if they do not comply with these requirements, they and their children lose part or all of their benefits. The first cut is a 10% cut. They can lose 30%. And if they're in a 7th month in which they're not complying, or 7th occurrence of not complying, they and their children lose all their benefits. We call these sanctions. The monthly benefits they receive are in this chart showing you by family size. So you'll see that it mentions a cash and a food benefit. Minnesota is the only state in the nation that sought and received a waiver from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to combine the cash assistance with this what we used to call food stamps and now call Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP benefits. this combination allows workers and families to track one set of rules, one set of reporting requirements, and to have earned income and outside income react to one benefit instead of multiple benefits. So for instance, for a family of three, the cash benefit is $632. The food benefit is $436. That, that's just over $1,000 a month. You can see to get to the poverty line is $1,700 a month. So the benefits the Minnesota Family Investment Program offers does not get families out of poverty. It doesn't even get them out of deep poverty. On the next slide, you'll see how those benefits interact with earned income. When the legislature designed and launched the Minnesota Family Investment Program, it put in mechanisms so that the program could support and reward work. So we do not offset every dollar of earnings with a loss of dollar in benefits. What happens instead is that if a parent has earnings, we ignore the first $65 earned, and then we also ignore 50% of what remains in those monthly earnings. This is a formula that the Federal Supplemental Security Income Program uses as well. So what you can see in this chart is that families who have no outside income are getting the full benefit. But if the parent in the second set of bars, if the parent is working 20 hours a week at $10 an hour, you see that $860 in the dark blue bar, but you see the green bar has dropped some. So the other thing to know is that we reduce the cash assistance first. And if you look at the set of bars where the parent is earning more than $1,500 a month, you see there's no cash. So it's only after that set of earnings that we begin reducing the food support amount. When a family of three gets to $2,400, that's about 140% of poverty, they're not eligible for any of the any MFIT benefits. I should also say with this chart, in 2013, the legislature created an additional benefit that many MFIP families are eligible for called the MFIP Housing Assistance Grant. That's $110 a month. So as long as the family is eligible for any MFIP, even just the food support, they'll get the $110 a month in addition to what you see on the chart. But once they hit that $2,400, that is gone with the other benefits. And that house, we'll look at how housing costs and the MFIP benefits interact. Back in 1986, when it was still the AFDC program, the $532 a month benefit, which is the benefit that was in place until 2019, that was a little more than the $480 that HUD said at the time was the fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment in the metro area. So we're looking at a family of three and assuming a two-bedroom apartment is likely what they'd need. By the mid-1990s, we see that the cost of a fair market rent apartment has begun to exceed the amount of benefits the income support program provides. And you see, if you go all the way to the right-hand part of the chart, there we are at 2020. Fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment is now, according to HUD, about $1,200 a month. The increase the legislature approved in 2019 has gotten the cash support up to $632. And again, for many families, if you look at the dotted line at the bottom, they're also getting $110. So they have $732 to apply to that $1,200 rent. For most families, MFIP is the only assistance they're getting to help pay with rent, pay the rent. 29% receive a federal housing subsidy, meaning a Section 8 voucher or living in public housing, but 71% are not receiving that help. And finally, I wanna just show you, we talked about family stabilization services, that special track for families. I wanted to show you sort of the makeup of what circumstances get someone in the family stabilization services track and also qualify them for an extension. But you'll see the most common reason is off to the left. The parent is ill enough to be incapacitated by their illness. In addition, you see that there's a number of parents in, who are disabled and are in the 1, 2 to 3 year process of applying for federal disability income support through the Supplemental Security Income Program. Another significant group are seriously mentally ill and have verification from a provider that that mental illness is interfering with employment. They may be, their family may be qualifying for waivered services because of their disabilities. They may be taking care of a child or a spouse who is seriously ill. They may have active domestic violence they're contending with. So those are the sort of conditions we see in that group. That is the high-level overview. Of course, very happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Really important. I just want to point out to members that it had been over 30 years that it took for us to actually increase MFIP by only $100. So definitely not keeping up with housing costs for these families. I do have one question, Ms. Schlick. Are we doing any evaluation on that housing component piece, that additional dollars we're spending there?
Chair Schultz, we have not looked specifically at the housing component. We try and we have done some work in the last couple of years across the public assistance programs to get a common field that the county workers can use when they're determining eligibility to let us know if a family is homeless or not. We are, I don't have the data off the top of my head, but I, any of us following the news have seen that the number are growing. Sometimes they're attached to the Minnesota Family Investment Program, sometimes they are not.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Another question has to do with the ability for individuals to work. There's work requirements for MFIP, but also to pay for childcare. So are the, some of these families also qualifying for childcare assistance?
Chairman Schultz, yes. They are about, it depends on the age of the child, but I'm looking at a chart to try and pull this off. Families with the youngest kids, about a third, up to a third of the families use the child care assistance available to them. As kids get older, the numbers drop. One of the conditions of the Minnesota Family Investment Program is that if a family is engaged in work activities, including work prep activities, they are eligible for child care assistance. And the program runs on the same rules and schedule that the basic sliding fee program uses.
And then one last question before I open it up to other members. Can you just discuss about the, I believe there was a group that got together to look at sanctions reform in MFIP. And I'm wondering if the agency has looked at innovative solutions from those recommendations around sanction reforms.
Chair Schultz, yes, the agency has engaged with counties, with advocates, and with tribal representatives to look at ways we could significantly simplify the sanction process. And people have very strong feelings about sanction, but whether people think sanctions are a good or a bad idea, they agree that sanctions need to be predictable and transparent and understandable in order to have any impact. We have very different policies for those who are extended beyond the 60-month time. They have to track over a family's lifetime when they were last sanctioned. That can mean years of tracking, even if someone's been off for a number of months. So there are a number of policy that are complicated, and there have been some good conversations.
Thank you for answering my questions, Ms. Schlick. Do other members have questions? Okay, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Schlick. The questions I have are, of course, around the MFIP program and around how does it work with youth who are experiencing homelessness? And I'm thinking of two categories, those who are under 18 who've been experiencing long-term homelessness and those who are over 18? Is there a difference, and how does it work in those type of situations?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Fisher. So unaccompanied youth who's homeless does not turn to the Minnesota Family Investment Program. They may receive assistance through general assistance, which is not a program I have deep knowledge of. But we do have some young parents, not a lot, but we have some teenagers, either minors or 18 or 19 year olds. And we do work with the Minnesota Department of Health, a collaborative effort over the last few years to try and encourage counties to enroll teen parents in home visiting so they can get that relationship-based service and ongoing service that looks deeply into all the needs of their family. And the struggles those counties tell us they're having with teens with homelessness is one that has been difficult to respond to effectively. Youth shelters often don't allow a young person with a child to stay in them, but to send a young person with a child into an adult shelter is also fraught. And so there are not many options for that group.
Representative Fisher, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Chair, Chair Schultz. And I appreciate you recognizing the difficulties that are in this area for youth who are homeless and the challenges they have. For those youth who do have children, who are, particularly some of those who are under 18, if they're able to qualify for MFIP, how does the five-year statute of limits apply to them? Is there some kind of exemption that because of the age and the challenges that they have, do they fall into that special category? How does that all work?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Fisher. So teenager who applies and receives MFIP, first of all, has to be attending high school in order to maintain eligibility. And as long as they're attending high school, they're not generating months that count towards their lifetime limit. As soon as they're finished with high school, if they're continuing to receive assistance through MFIP, then the months will begin counting. And some of those do see what we see about a young parent who ends up on MFIP is they not only have a fiscal crisis, but we often find that they bring with them a history of being victims of violence, mental illness, and special education needs. So they are often not parents who, once they're adulthood, are able to move off MFIP quickly.
Representative Fisher.
Okay, thank you, Chair Schultz and Ms. Schlick. You've helped highlight some of the issues that are out there. I appreciate the information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. The first is around the eligibility, the income guidelines. I'm wondering how those numbers are determined or who determines those numbers.
Ms. Schlick?
The numbers are determined by the legislation that creates the Minnesota Family Investment Program and are also a product of the benefits. So you have to, a family to be eligible has to have less income than the benefits provide. Once they're on the program and have earnings, the statute that dictates that we disregard some of those earnings helps set then what the exit level will be.
Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my second question then is, I'm wondering about the rates of usage and the caseload. The numbers of folks who are utilizing this program, can you share with us how that might look differently in 2020 given COVID versus previous years? Have you noticed a difference that you can speak to?
Ms. Schlick?
Representative Chair Schultz and Representative Bolden. Yes, we have seen our caseloads grow. I'm sorry, I should have a slide open right now, and I don't, that I could confer with, but we had been seeing steady decrease over the last few years. We were down to a number of families in the mid 20,000, which is the lowest ever in the history of the program. We're now up in the neighborhood of more than 30,000 families. So during COVID, the numbers have increased.
Representative Bolden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No follow-up.
Thank you. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Schlick, and I'm going to tag into what Representative Bolden said, but in a little bit different circumstance. You mentioned in terms of the industry sectors that typically individuals and families that seek the support of MFIP certainly have been hit hard by COVID, but have you also seen kind of a transient nature to, if you were to put a heat map together in terms of where families that are seeking assistance from MFIP program, say pre-COVID and now, is there any difference in terms of where those families across the state are making application?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Albright, I have not seen any analysis of that to date to see if it has, like geographically across Minnesota, whether there has been change. I could see if such analysis exists and we could follow up. But we've always seen that all counties in the state have families who turn to the Minnesota Family Investment Program. I have got a note from a colleague as well, so I could be more specific to answer Representative Bolden's question, that the number of families turning to MFIP increased by about 5,000 from March when the shelter-in-place orders were put into place to October of this last fall. But we could follow up on that question about whether there's a difference in pattern around the state.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Schlick, just in a follow-up then, and anecdotally speaking then, if you were to not speculate, but give an assessment in terms of across the state, is it more of an urban utilization versus greater Minnesota? And is it centric to counties? Any observations that you might make would be helpful.
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Albright, I have not seen that. If you look at whole numbers, the Twin Cities will always be greater in number. I don't know that they're greater in proportion. And so it's a question I'd like to take back to our analysts.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just as a comment to that, I think that's really important. This program is very, very important. And as you and I have talked on a number of occasions, there's a cliff after a year that people really kind of run up against. And I think this is the subject matter that this committee really needs to spend some very concentrated effort on identifying how we move these people into a position where they can survive, if you will, on more than just what you've described. It's a Band-Aid, but it also points a greater issue that I hope that this committee takes up with great seriousness. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Good to hear you say those comments. I think we'll have some bills coming to committee. And Representative Noor, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Schlick, I just have a couple of questions. The first one is, before an individual moves into an MFIP program, they're required to go to the diversionary work program. What's the relationship between MFIP and DWP?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Noor. The diversionary work program is a four-month income support program that was created by the legislature in 2003. It is directed at families who've not received any income support, through MFIP or another state's TANF program in the last 12 months. And there are other exceptions. And that is that four-month program is focused on intensive job search services, with a mission of seeing if they can get families back into jobs before the 4 months is up. Analysis done a few years after the program was implemented showed that in a 12-month period, it didn't change the number of families that are using cash assistance for 12 months or less. So it sort of captured a churning pattern that was already there in the program, that many families turn to cash assistance for short periods of time in a specific crisis. And the diversionary, we have not been enrolling families in the diversionary work program during the COVID crisis as a way to reduce the duplication of intake, so that counties are, you know, having to be manage fewer cases and or activities on existing cases.
Representative Neuer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My other question is for recipients of MFIP. There's a required, if it's not a household of two, you know, the two parents, there's a requirement for refer to child support. How has the two systems, you know, interacted in terms of collection and support for the families using the child support systems?
Ms. Schlick.
Chair Schultz and Representative Neuer. Yes, you're right. Federal government requires us and the state law requires us to have a single parent who applies for cash assistance cooperate with child support enforcement in order to receive that assistance. About 25% of the families who receive assistance through MFIP actually see some child support provided to them. As of a few years ago, the legislature changed policy so that the first $100 a family receives in that child support, if it's just for one child, will not count against their MFIP benefits. The first $200, if it's two or more children, won't count. So that was done to increase the impact so that that child support payment could add to the benefits, not just offset the benefits.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Neuer, do you have any more questions before we move on?
One final question. I know I can be sitting here asking tons of questions about MFIP program. I do have a question. I know I've used the MAXIS system as a county worker from the county, and I manage system management through DHS. The complicated systems that we're using from the application process to getting the benefits, I know we talked about systems modernization. The MAXIS system is more than 30 years. What is the future looking into from an individual to apply for a program to getting the benefits in a system that we can all understand that it's more efficient and effective? Is there a plan into the future for that?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Neuer. I have expertise to answer almost none of that question except one important slice, and that is we have been working with counties and advocates, not only on the sanction reform, but for other ideas to simplify the very complex policies that govern this program. Those complex policies are not only hard on an old IT system, but they will make the move to a new IT system much more expensive and take longer to realize.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Noor. We're gonna move on because we have about 5 more minutes that we can spend on this topic. So I think I have Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Schlick. I had just a follow-up regarding the policy about the exclusion. You'd said earlier that 40% of the families are on for 12 months and then leave the program and generally don't return. 7% do reach that 60-month limit. But of that, there's a 20% sort of allowance, it sounded like, for people that the state can choose to say they don't have to abide by that 60-month limit. So do we meet that 20%, or how do those numbers square with who's in that 20%, or do we not hit that exclusion number? And then secondly, if you can follow up with me later, but of the families in the program, I'd like to know, referencing Representative Noor's question, how many are single parent families versus two parent families? Thank you.
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Robbins. So I'll first explain that 42% is of the parents who turn to us at any point in time, 42% will rely on that assistance for 12 months or less and be done. The 7% is the number of families we've served through MFIP since the program began in 1998. So all the families we've ever served, only 7% have reached that lifetime limit. We are well below the 20% that the federal government sets us as a maximum. Let me pull up the number for you right now. So right now, 6% of the families receiving assistance in a month are beyond the five-year lifetime limit. So we're very far from the 20% that the federal government has set. Two-parent families are a smaller part of our caseload. We have, excuse me, I just pulled that for you. We have about 4,600 households where there's a two-parent family, compared to about 16,000 households where there's a single-parent family. A large part of that is the product of the question earlier, because the income limits to qualify are so very low, it'd be very hard for a two-parent family, if either parent was employable for any number of hours, to be able to have low enough income to qualify.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Robbins, any follow-up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Schlick.
Thank you. Representative Sandell, last question on this topic. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Schlick. How well do these programs serve for families that may have one or more undocumented workers in the family?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Sandell. So undocumented individuals are not eligible for assistance. It might be possible that an undocumented parent has citizen children. The citizen children would be eligible. The parent's income would have benefits, but the parent would not be eligible.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you. Just one more quick follow-up. Thank you, Chair Schultz. What's your estimate of families that do not meet the eligibility requirements, that is, families that may have undocumented adults?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Sandell, I don't have that number, but I think I could get it from our analysts and get it to you. It's a fairly small number.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Representative Sandell, and thank you, Ms. Schlick, for your presentation. We look forward to the follow-up information you'll provide to our members. Okay, next on our agenda is an overview of the Federal Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF, Block Grant Program, and this is going to be presented by Dave Greenman, the DHS Budget Director. Go ahead, Mr. Greenman, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dave Greenman. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services, and I'm going to present some information about the TANF program, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, as well as our maintenance of effort requirement related to TANF. And then also at the end of the presentation, I'll provide a slide that shows that wasn't included in your packet, but that shows how we spend our TANF block grants. The first thing I would say is the TANF block grant is a $263 million block grant that Minnesota receives from the federal government. This came out of, as Ms. Schlick mentioned early in her presentation, this came out of the 1996 Federal Welfare Reform Bill. And there are four main purposes in federal law to the TANF block grant. One is to provide assistance to needy families so children can be cared for in their own homes or in the homes of relatives, to end dependence on needy parents, of needy parents on government benefits by promoting job preparation, work, and marriage, preventing and reducing out-of-wedlock pregnancies, and then encouraging the formation and maintenance of two-parent families. Federal law does require that a state must maintain state spending of at least 75 to 80% of the amount that was spent under the old AFDC program related programs in 1994 on qualified eligible families. So for Minnesota, that's about $175 million or $187 million. And the difference in the two matching or the maintenance of effort requirements has to do with whether you meet work participation requirements or not. And Minnesota, the lower percentages for states that meet work participation requirements, and Minnesota virtually always meets its work participation requirements. So we currently have a matching or maintenance of effort requirement of about $175 million. And generally, TANF is available to households with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. So spending on those households qualifies both for TANF, as long as it meets one of the four purposes in federal law. And then also, it qualifies as maintenance of effort if it's state spending. Next slide, please. So eligible families, activities that qualify for the maintenance of effort under federal law include child cash assistance, child care assistance, educational activities that are designed to increase self-sufficiency. Other programs or benefits that meet one of the four purposes of TANF, and then administrative costs for both the counties and state and the state in connection with those expenditures. And then there's non-assistance expenditures for on healthy marriage promotion and responsible fatherhood grants. Those would also qualify for maintenance of effort under the federal law. Next slide. Minnesota, TANF is one of the few federally funded programs in the state where the maintenance of effort requirement is actually established in state law. So what we can spend and count of state spending against our maintenance of effort is actually established in state law. The types of activities that we can do include the Minnesota Family Investment Program expenditures, the Child Care Assistance Program expenditures, state and county MFIP administrative expenditures, some qualifying expenditures from Head Start, and then also some qualifying working family tax credit expenditures also qualify for our maintenance of effort. And this next slide shows you for the past several years and then projections for the current year, what we spend to hit our maintenance of effort requirements. So you can see county and state administration is about $17 million in the past couple of years, but it goes up to about $19.6 million in the future. We spend about $6.34 million on employment and training that we can count against our maintenance of effort requirements. The working family tax credit amount that we spend significantly more than $6.7 million, but the amount that we can actually count against our maintenance of effort requirement is set in session law at $6.707 million. I'm not sure where exactly that figure came from, but it predates me, and I think it, I'm not sure where that number comes from. Head Start is, we believe we count about $5.7 million in state spending on Head Start against our maintenance of effort requirement. Child care is our child care expenditures with state dollars, as you can see there, we're in the neighborhood of between $110 and $90 million. And then state spending on MFIP, cash and food, is about ranges, but it depends on how much childcare spending we have that we can count towards MOE. Sometimes it goes up if there's less childcare spending. The MFIP portion of the maintenance of effort will go up. But it is we do require in state law that at least 16% of the MOE requirement come from state expenditures for MFIP. And that's been in session law for a number of years. And then recoveries and recruitments are the last items. Next slide, please. So one of the things that people are aware of, or some people are aware of, is that the state's projected to have a surplus in our TANF fund of about $71.4 million at the end of fiscal year 25. And this is a one-time surplus. So this is not an ongoing or structural surplus. The balance is driven by two main factors, this large surplus, the temporary shift of some groups to state-funded portion of MFIP in response to the COVID peacetime emergency. Ms. Schlick mentioned that families are not going on the diversionary work program during COVID. Instead, they're being put on based on some limitations in our computer systems, our MAXIS system. We had to put those people on a state-funded program initially, and so we're moving them off now onto the regular MFIP program that pays for, uses both TANF and general fund. But for a while, though, those folks were just being put on a state-funded program. And then the second reason why we're seeing an increase in the TANF balance is that we need to increase state spending for COVID, for MFIP, in order to meet the TANF MOE requirements. And for both of those reasons, TANF spending has gone down. And so that's why we have a significant balance at the end of fiscal year 25. TANF funds can be used to, we can spend the TANF fund balance on a number of things. As a reminder, we can spend them on the four purposes of TANF. And as you can see, I mentioned those earlier. Those are ways in which we can spend the fund balance down. Some of the ways we currently spend TANF, I'll show in a few minutes. Next slide, please. So this is our, this is how we spend our TANF money currently. As you can see, at the top, there's the TANF block grant base. That's the amount of TANF money we get every year. It's about $260 million. It does actually go up to $263 million with some additional incentive payments that we receive. Actual and estimated uses of the TANF block grant, we spend about $2.7 million on administration, both state and county administration. Of our TANF dollars, we spend about $98 million, $94 million on the Minnesota Family Investment Program. So these are the state and this is the MFIT program that Ms. Schlick was talking about. We also spend a significant amount of our TANF block grant on support services grants. And these are grants that go out to counties with federal dollars that we use to support low-income families. So some of this money could be used for a variety of purposes, including short-term shelter and transportation services, job training, employment services, education, work supports, including equipment that people might use if they're going to be doing work participation, like boots and clothing, and also wage subsidies. So those are it's a wide variety of funds or uses that the support services grants can be used for, but it's a significant source of funding to the counties to help with their job training efforts. And then we also spend smaller amounts on children's services grants. And then there are some dollars that pass through to the counties to help administer the TANF, counties and tribes to help administer the TANF grants through pass-through grants, and that's about projected to be about 5.3 million this year. So total direct expenditures by DHS on TANF in fiscal year 21 was about $177 million. The legislature also appropriates about $11.7 million per year to be transferred to the Department of Health. And the Health Department has a number of programs that are funded with TANF. I believe these include family home visiting and a number of other programs as well. So total TANF spending in fiscal year 21 is projected to be about $189 million. In addition to direct spending, we also transfer money from the TANF account. So this includes funding that we spend on the social services block grant. We supplement what the federal government gives us of about $4.8 million. And then we also transfer about $60 million to the child care development block grant. So we actually, the child care development fund, which supplements the child care development block grant to pay for child care assistance programs for families in Minnesota. We had been spending general fund money, TANF money, on the work and family tax credit. However, under legislation passed in 2019, that has stopped. We no longer spend TANF on the working family tax credit. So as you can see in fiscal year 2021, total uses of TANF dollars were about $254 million as compared to about $353 million in resources available, which is why we have a balance at the end of 21 of about $99.5 million. And that balance in the TANF fund, as you can see, is going to remain at about $71.4 million at the end of fiscal year 25. So that's how we spend our, that's how we use our TANF block grant at this point. And the TANF, I should add that TANF is direct appropriated by the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. I'm gonna proceed. We have one more testifier, Jessica Webster from Legal Aid, and then we'll have about hopefully 5 minutes left for questions. So go ahead, Ms. Webster.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and I just wanted to provide some really brief comments about what Legal Aid saw in terms of families accessing MFIP during COVID. And so Legal Aid serves low-income families and children and seniors and people statewide. So we have offices across the state. And what we saw in our offices, a few global things. Federal stimulus payments were not a given for families accessing MFIP. We were still trying and working to help families access payments. A lot of families are unbanked, and so they didn't show up as a direct deposit into an account, or families didn't know the form that had to be filled out with an updated address and updated information to get that payment. Families also got incorrect stimulus amounts. So if they had two children, they would get a stimulus for one child, but not the other. And so that was something that we were continuing to work on the summer and fall. And I suspect we'll be working on that with the second stimulus payment as well. So those funds were not a given for these families. The other thing is, most families that we see and most families accessing MFIP didn't have access to that $600 that really generous $600 UI payment each week, even though the folks that we see in MFIP tend to work in those industries that were really hard hit, hotel, restaurant, retail, smaller retail. And so those dollars weren't available to families either. And then just moving really specifically into the MFIP program, this is a really, really rigid program. It is full of rules and paperwork and reporting. It is definitely the most complicated and onerous program I see and work with in the state of Minnesota. We ask families to fill out an 8-page packet every month. It feels a little bit like filing your taxes every single month that you participate in this program. And I did give the committee a copy of that monthly household report form, and I won't share my screen, but you can see it's sharing everything from rent and earnings and pay stubs to, did you receive more than $60 from your church or from a family member that needs to be reported? There's a lot of different detail that has to be verified in that monthly report, both so the county workers have to verify those. So these monthly household report forms were actually paused during COVID, and workers, all the verifications and paperwork that are attached to these were also paused. And that was really helpful to families in terms of the stress and the difficulty of these paper forms. And Minnesota is the only state that has these monthly report forms. All other states have 6-month reporting, and that's also what is in our SNAP program, a 6-month report. So this is something that was paused that was helpful. The thing that the reason that we care, that Legal Aid and other families care about these forms, is that if you don't do these forms correctly or you don't submit them, then you face what you heard discussed earlier in this term, sanction. And what a sanction means is that a parent with 2 children could lose $300 or be penalized $300 for on their grants for the month that they didn't submit this paperwork, filled it out incorrectly, didn't report their hours to their worker. And so this paperwork is really important, and it has a penalty tied to it that has really, really sharp teeth. The other thing that was helpful was the pause on in-person meetings. This program tends to emphasize in-person meetings, and the use of the telephone was actually rather helpful for families during COVID, and it's something that I hope down the road we can consider, using that in 2021, the use of the telephone. And then just some more kind of global reflections, or the eviction moratorium for these families was life-saving. As you saw Ms. Schlick present, the cash grant, the average cash grant in MFIP, and even the highest cash grant you can get does not pay for a fair market rent anywhere in the state. And the last thing I would say is that we still saw many, many parents working during this time. They were essential workers. They were working frontline in retail and in on and off with restaurant and janitorial. And the workers that, one of the things that we heard was people were really stressed out and concerned about going to work and not having PPE or not being safe, but they still went. And there's a lot of heroic folks that did a lot of good work during this time that were also participating in the MFIP program. So that's what I will conclude my remarks with. Thanks very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. It's really useful to hear that information. And I think we're learning a lot during COVID. Then hopefully we can extend that exemption for the in-person meetings and do phone or Zoom meetings to make it easier on families. We have a few hands up. I'm going to go to Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you so much. I just want to make a quick comment just to point out for members, Mr. Greenman went through showed us the spreadsheet. And there's a lot on there that we spend our block grant on that isn't money for families. And a lot of that is very valuable stuff. But the fact that you all saw the graph and how much we've increased the grant over the years, which is just pitifully low, even though we were so proud of ourselves for getting an extra $100 in there last session after 33 years. But it's pitifully low. And I just think when I look at that and you see how little money a family gets, with all the rigmarole that Ms. Webster is describing, that you go through all those hoops and you're still living way below the poverty line. And I don't know if this was mentioned, but is it 2/3 of the people on MFIP are actually the children, or maybe it's even more than that. So this is what we're doing to Minnesota's children, right? This is what we're doing to people who are going to be our citizens in just a few years. And one of the great things the Walz administration did was refinance, take tax piece out of the TANF fund to leave a little bit more money there. And I would just so love it if we could take some of those other important functions that we pay for and move them out of the TANF fund. Because I really believe that the way to help a lot of these families is to give them more money so that they can actually have a little breather while they're on MFIP and be able to focus on something besides the daily grind of being in deep, deep poverty. And that way help them pull themselves up. Because if you're so focused on just every little piece of your existence, I can only imagine how hard it is to really pull yourself up out of poverty, as we're expecting them to do while they're on our program. So I just really wanted to flag that for members. I hope we can continue to look for ways to get those other expenditures out of that fund so that those monies can go to the families who really should be getting that money. And we could come somewhere near the cost of living so that when somebody's on our program, they at least have what we intend to give them through the program, which is a little bit of respite from poverty so they can get themselves permanently out of poverty. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, for those excellent comments. Representative Albright.
I'll be brief, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr. Greenman, just a quick a question and observation about kind of the continuation from fiscal 18 through fiscal 21. I note that there's been an increase in the state MFIP, but there's been a decrease in the amount allocated to child care. And I'm wondering if you could just make any observations that you know of in terms of the rationale for that. And then a follow-up, Madam Chair, while I have it, is for Mr. Greenman, in terms of are there any performance metrics for success regarding the TANF block grant that we need to measure along the lines of those four goals that you mentioned pertaining to the block grant themselves? And anecdotal or otherwise, are we being successful with the block grant itself in providing and preserving families and providing for children not to have to worry about their success in life? Can you speak to that secondarily to the funding disparities that I see in your Excel spreadsheet? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, the funding for the Child Care Development Fund is generally set at about $49.7 million a year, the transfer amount. It has been higher. It was higher in this year, and then it's also projected to be somewhat higher in the next several years. I'd have to go back and talk to our childcare folks and find out a little bit more about why they expect that money to be increased. I'm not 100% sure why, but I can certainly look into that and get back to you with more information about that. And then in terms of performance measures, I don't have, I think somebody from the Children and Family Services Administration would probably be better able to respond to that. I don't have that information about what it is, what we'd have to do in order to show that we're meeting performance measures. I'm not sure if Deborah Schlick is available or not. Maybe she can speak
to that. She is. Ms. Schlick, go ahead.
Chair Schultz and representatives. So in terms of performance measures, there's a couple of things to know about the Minnesota Family Investment Program. The first is that the federal performance measure we're held to is a process measure, not an outcome measure. We're asked to ensure that a certain percentage of parents are in one of 12 recognized activities for a minimum number of hours, and the minimum number of hours depends on the age of their children. And that's called the work participation rate. And that's how the federal government holds the TANF program accountable. However, they do not ask us how many parents get jobs that take them off assistance. They only look at parents who have jobs that are still on assistance. So it's been a problematic measure in that sense, since it doesn't actually look at outcomes. In response, the Minnesota State Legislature created an alternative measure for the state called the Self-Support Index. It looks at how many families are served over that are receiving MFIP. They look at all the parents receiving MFIP in a quarter. They follow them for 3 years.
I'm going to have to cut you off there, Ms. Schlick. We have to end right on time for House information to move to the next committee. I know there are members with questions. I hope you submit them to our testifiers. I thank everyone for joining us today. I will see everyone tomorrow at 10:30 when we talk about programs on PCAs and disability waivers. So have a good afternoon, everyone. Thank you.